double murders within a 5-year time frame. The first in 2008 and the second in 2013 would have police in Omaha, Nebraska wondering if they had a serial killer on their hands. The only real link was each victim's affiliation with Creighton University in Omaha and a former medical resident there named Anthony Garcia. Years later, and hours away in Chicago, Illinois, criminal defense attorney Bob Mata would receive a message in the middle of the night from Garcia's family requesting legal representation. And the years that followed would be a series of bizarre rabbit holes and one of the most exhausting and interesting trials in Nebraska history. Today, I talk with Bob Mata about the Anthony Garcia case, podcasting, mental health, and so much more. I'm Kelly Behrens-Brink, and this is True Crime IRL, part one of our deep dive into the Anthony Garcia case. Hey guys, it's Kelly. I have just a few small items of business before I get into today's episode. First off, I want to remind everyone that I have my live show on Thursday, September 9th at 6 p.m. at Franklin Street Brewing Company in Manchester, Iowa. It's always a great time to get together with friends, sample some craft brews, and mingle with some fellow weirdos about true crime. And then I'll be in Savannah, Georgia at the Savannah Crime Expo on September 25th, along with tons of your favorite other authors, speakers, and true crime podcasters. And you can go to savannahcrimeexpo.com to get your tickets. I'm super excited for that, and I can't wait to see everyone there. So in this episode, I collaborated with the Defense Diaries team, Bob Mata and Darren Wood. And it was one of the highlights of my podcasting career so far, but hey, don't tell them I said that, okay? We actually recorded over the course of a weekend in this absolutely amazing, super old mansion that's being restored along the Mississippi River. And we just had the best convos. We chatted about podcasting and true crime, and we brainstormed about a lot of other cases we want to crack. It was awesome. And I really hope you enjoy our crazy banter because we do get super off topic a lot, but hey, we had fun, so it was all good. So one quick word from our sponsors, and then we'll get down to it. And now back to the show. This is Kelly Behrens-Brink from True Crime IRL, and today we are covering another Midwest serial killer case. Although in my definition of the word, this really isn't a serial killer case. We're going to get to that later. But we're being joined by Bob Mata from a fantastic podcast called The Defense Diaries, all about John Wayne Gacy. And if you want to rewind a few episodes, you're going to see that I did a live episode on John Wayne Gacy that was pretty awesome. So go check that out. But for now, we're talking about Anthony Garcia. Bob, tell me a little bit about what you know about Anthony Garcia, because I'm just going to say I am not very familiar with this case at all. I've binged for a couple days in preparation for this, but I really don't know a lot about him. So tell me a little bit about your affiliation with this case.
Well, hi, Kelly.
Well, hi, Bob.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you in person.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad to be doing this with you.
Rewind. Okay, I first met you at True Crime Podcast Festival in Kansas City in June of this year. So
true story.
Yep, that's where we met, and I was you did some.
We did like a live episode.
So you did a live episode on John Wayne Gacy and the Defense Diaries. You did that. You had a booth at True Crime Podcast Festival. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
My current profession is I am a criminal defense attorney. I've been doing that for about 20 years. I was born and raised in a suburb of Chicago, Illinois, called Oak Park. I ended up going to law school at the same place that my father went, which was kind of cool. He got to hood me, which is when you graduate from law school, you get hooded, and they essentially put a hood on you. It's It's kind of a neat ceremony. I ended up practicing out in Philadelphia for a few years. Met my wife in law school at Chicago Kent. And we've been practicing together for now going on 20 years. And, you know, that took some getting used to in terms of kind of spending all of our time together. But over the course of the years, we were able to kind of figure that out somewhat. Basically, kind of the backstory on how I decided to get into the podcasting, just kind of in a real short story, was that back in 1978, my father represented serial killer John Wayne Gacy, along with Sam Amaranti. If you fast forward probably about, I think, 13 years after that, he ends up giving me 15 hours of his recorded interviews with John Wayne Gacy that he did pre-trial in anticipation of the trial.
What a weird gift, right?
It was definitely weird. It was definitely a weird gift.
But nobody else can say they got that for their birthday, and that's not something you're really going to re-gift.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no re-gifting on that one. It was definitely strange, and I sat on them forever. Like, I had no clue what to do with them.
Like, you were just like, thanks, Dad. I would have rather had a car or something. Like, yeah,
it wasn't even something. That's exactly what it was. It, you know, I really was hoping. I was 21. I had been driving around in a Beater. So I was rooting for a car for my 21st, and I end up getting those tapes.
A box of cassette tapes.
And like I said, I didn't really know what to do with them for the longest period of time. And I flirted with the idea of licensing the sound out to Netflix and A&E. Had gotten into some protracted conversations with both of those companies in trying to sell them. And, you know, I wanted to make a profit off of it, you know, really to help my father, you know, more than anything else financially with, you know, because once the sound on the tapes is out there, they have no inherent value. There is nothing left for me to sell per se. So, you know, the deals with Netflix and A&E fell apart. And in 2 years prior to when I was trying to negotiate those deals, I had discovered Serial, the podcast.
That's how we all started, right?
I mean, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes. that was my maiden voyage into listening to podcasts.
Side note.
Yeah.
Adnan.
Yeah.
Guilty or innocent? Maybe you might not want to put that out there because it's a very controversial opinion to have.
My gut is that he's innocent.
Oh, well, you know? That's coming from a defense attorney.
Right. I probably do tend towards the innocent.
Yeah.
But his eyes don't say killer to me, you know, and I've always felt that.
But did Ted Bundy's eyes say killer when? Yes, oh, everyone's shaking their heads unanimously. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, like the women who think he was handsome, his eyes, I don't know.
Yeah.
They were kind of nice.
He's got those like dead eyes, like a shark. Like guys that do that kind of shit, if you look at them, like you can typically, they've got what I call dead eyes.
So this is like a real thing.
Like, oh, yeah.
When you look in their eyes, they're soulless, basically.
I'm a pretty good judge of that. Like I have been throughout my career in terms of kind of being able to look at somebody and kind of pinpoint whether or not, you know, and obviously if I'm dealing with drug dealer cases, I'm not like, digging into their soul, you know,
right.
But when I'm dealing with kind of a horrific type of crime, you know, I think that typically I can kind of see what's going on with them. And from what I've seen, when you look at any of the most prolific serial killers, if you really look at them and kind of look at what their eyes look like, they have that kind of like, they're almost black.
Yeah.
Like they just are kind of soulless, like you said.
Like, but zoning out, kind of looking right through you.
Yeah, it's like,
on another level. Like,
I don't know if it's a narcissistic thing that they all have going on, but, you know, it's just, there's nothing there. There's nothing behind it, you know, mm-hmm. where, you know, because I can tell typically, like, if somebody's a kind soul, you know, I can typically tell that from their eyes. Right. You know, so.
Like me.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, I think once I kind of, I listened to Serial and I fell in love with the concept of podcasts. I thought it was such a neat medium that I had never really tinkered with at all. And I'd always been kind of an audio guy, like in terms of like I listen, I learn more listening than I do visually. So, I mean, it was really right up my alley. So I had said something to somebody at some point who was kind of in the entertainment industry, and she was like, oh, you know, that's a great idea. But I sat on it. You know, I didn't do anything with it because it was kind of nerve-wracking. And at that point, I had no idea, which, of course, you know how much work what we do is. You know, yeah, from that point forward, I decided to give it a shot with the podcasting. I called Darren, who's one of my closest friends.
And hi, Darren.
I hit him up and...
You know what? You need to get Darren on the mic. Darren on the mic.
I agree. Yeah. I agree.
He's hilarious, and he's got a lot of good insight.
He does. He's one of the brighter people that I know in my life, and I know some smart people, and he's right at the top of the list. So.
Well, you're lucky, I would say.
Yeah.
You're lucky to have him on your team.
I am.
Yeah. What were you talking about?
Me.
Always you.
Always me. Okay, so enough about me. Let's hear a little bit about you. What's your backstory?
Well, something you said that struck me was you didn't have a lot of experience with like listening to audio stuff. And you know, like podcasts are, I mean, they've been around for a decade, but they're relatively new on the trending front. Like they're really getting popular now. Like everyone listens to a podcast, and I've been listening to podcasts like you for a decade, like Serial. That was a long time ago. But I've always been a fan of old-time radio shows, things like that. I used to listen to a lot of Garrison Keillor, something on like Lake Wobegon.
Oh, I think Lake Wobegon was the town.
Okay, I need to look it up.
Yeah, look it up. I thought it was This American Life. Is that
NPR, dummy.
Yeah, but wasn't Garrison Keillor on NPR?
I think his show was. Yeah, Lake Wobegon. Yeah.
Wobegon.
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 Wobegon. I mean, it makes more sense. Wobegon, you know.
News from Lake Wobegon.
Wobegon.
Wobegon. This is how nerdy I am. I used to sit in my living room on like a Friday or Saturday night, and I'd put on a Garrison Keillor podcast thing or whatever. But it was reminiscent of old-time radio days.
Totally.
And I just love, like, I can't listen and watch things at the same time. That's why I'm the same way. I love podcasts. I love radio. I love all of that. And that's what I've done since I was 20 years old. I mean, I started in radio. That's where my background is. Like,
tell
radio.
Me more about that.
So my first real job was radio advertising sales. So in the town I lived in, it was a very small town. We would sell the advertisements. We would write the ads. We would sometimes voice the ads, all the stuff. And it was just totally my jam. I loved it. After a while of working in advertising, I was like the program director of a radio station, and I had my own show.
Oh,
and
you got
everything.
On air.
Yeah. All right. Oh, so much airtime. And with no experience, I had to teach myself everything, and I did. And it still translates to today. It helps me today. Like,
well, because you're like a one-woman show, right? I mean, you're producing,
yeah, I do
writing.
It all. I do it all.
Doing all your recording.
For now. But if there are any fans out there who would love to volunteer and help me edit and do all that shit, just come on. Yeah, I'll give you an internship. I'll write you a great letter of recommendation. Just come.
Yeah, don't be trying to steal Darren from me either.
Darren. Darren likes Jameson.
Yeah, he's a JMO guy.
I love JMO. Oh, speaking of that. So I've started this partnership with this podcast in Ireland called Cheap Heat Productions, which is crazy because they're like a pro wrestling show. Did I ever think in my life I would be collabing with pro wrestling?
I would think not.
No. But do you know what? There is a lot of like murder mystery and crazy crime drama that has happened in the pro wrestling world.
Really?
It's ridiculous. So much so that we're starting our own like sideshow once a month on pro wrestling and crime. It's
but
crazy.
Is it as fake as the actual wrestling is? Or is it real murder?
It's real murder.
Real
and it's like
murder.
Not just murder, but murder mystery.
Wow. I mean, that that is an added element that really is important because, you know, I mean, the mystery is kind of the fun of it, you know.
It is the fun of it.
I mean, we all like cracking cases, right? I mean, cracking cases is kind of the best part of it.
It is.
So, all right. So you're in this radio gig for how long did you do that?
Couple years.
Couple years. And then what did Kelly do after radio?
Kelly was a mom.
Kelly mommed.
Yeah. Right. I mommed so hard. And I worked on my degree. Like I went back to school. I got my communications degree through the University of Iowa.
How many kids you got?
I have three boys.
Three boys.
Yeah.
So you mom for a while.
So much momming. And then I worked at the University of Iowa. I got through school.
Well, you told me something cool when we were talking the other night, you know, and I was all excited about the Field of Dreams game.
Yeah.
Because my boys were playing in that game.
So I live about 15 minutes from the Field of Dreams.
Cool. I mean, at this point, it's a movie set, right? I mean,
it's a movie set, and it's the claim to fame for that area of Iowa, and it's an awesome thing to see. It. We get so many tourists coming through, especially in the summertime, obviously, when the corn is growing, and it's a beautiful, green, lush place to visit. It's a big tourist attraction, so.
I thought that game was magical when the Major League Baseball put it together. Like, when, I don't know if you watched. I think you were actually doing a live show the night that was on.
Yeah, I was doing my live show that night.
Right, so you didn't get the opportunity to see it, but they did an amazing job, and it was like, you know, I don't know if it's a guy thing with Field of Dreams, because it's, you know, the dad and the son having a catch, and I cry every single time. I've seen it 50 times, cry every time. I can't help it.
It's you just, cry?
Oh, I cry like a baby. I cry like a baby.
I'm playing that movie later. Yeah, I want to see that.
I'm an emotional guy. So yeah, that actually every time it gets me. But the game was so beautiful, and the Major League Baseball had done such a beautiful job building, because they didn't play on the movie set. They actually built a separate field, put about, I think, 8,000 seats in the stands so they could actually have a crowd out there. And it was just really, really well done. I mean, so well done that I think the Cubs and the Reds are playing another game, Field of Dreams, next year. So it's pretty neat.
Iowa was really on stage. It was beautiful. It was
beautiful.
Yeah.
It really was.
They really just...
It was breathtaking.
Nailed it.
They crushed it. And like just watching those guys like hit the balls into the cornfield was so beyond cool.
That is cool.
So I really enjoyed that. So when did you decide, you know, that you were going to fuck with podcasting?
Fuck with podcasting. Right. So I've always been a dark person, like really since I was like out the womb. Like I've always loved all the ghost stories, just scary shit. I started watching like Dateline, Unsolved Mysteries, all of that stuff when I was very young. I've just always been fascinated by it. But I started my podcast in 2019. So like I said before, I've listened to podcasts forever. And after a while, I was like, you know what? I want to hear some stories from the Midwest. I wanted to make the show that I wanted to hear as a listener. So I did that. I kind of like honed in on my radio past and my skills from the past and stuff. I was like, I could totally do this. And I did it. And very quickly, as a stay-at-home mom with three kids, I realized that's a lot of work. Like, it's a lot of work. It's not just recording or like enjoying a story and talking about it. It's so much more than that. There's the editing, there's the website work, the social media, all of it. And I gave up very quickly, but I had a very special person in my life who is kind of one of my mentors. He's a private investigator. He's spent most of his life working in the media. But anyway, he reached out to me and he was like, you're talented. You need to really like get back into this. I listened to all your episodes and then they stopped. Why did they stop? So I started back with that with a vengeance, really.
When did you start back?
In 2021, February of 2021. So,
okay, so you're just getting back into it.
Just getting back into it, but I'm full time basically. Like it's my life.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, that's kind of, yeah, if you're going to do it, that is kind of how it turns out being. You know, it's kind of all encompassing. It just takes, and One of the things that you didn't mention that both of us do, and which we're not doing today, is, you know, we write our scripts. You know, you and I both are writers. But, you know, at the heart of it, we're writing what we're speaking. Today, we're winging it a little bit.
We are winging it, and I'm so uncomfortable with this.
Oh, you're doing great.
So I do a live show once a month, and I always tell people I'm not good at this live stuff. Like, I'm not good at it, and I don't love the, like, unscripted interviews and things like that, but here we are. So,
yeah, no, I
but
think I you're
do
doing
like,
great.
I like to talk to people, so.
Right, which is what we're
that's
doing.
That's what we're doing.
Exactly.
And we are talking about Anthony Garcia.
Yeah, let's talk about that guy.
So we probably should get to it, right?
I think so.
Like I said, I had not heard a lot about this case, this person, until I think you mentioned him to me. Okay, so he's a serial killer in the Omaha, Nebraska area. And serial killer, I'm like air quoting that. I don't think he's a serial killer. We probably differ on that opinion a little bit, because what makes a serial killer? For me, okay, we're going to get into the details of Anthony Garcia, but what I am going to say is he's not a serial killer. He did kill four people, but I think he had a different MO than most serial killers have. And I think there's a psychological thing with serial killers that isn't present in his stuff. But you know a lot more than I do about this case. And tell me how you know all of that.
Yeah, I do know probably a little bit more about that case than you. I ended up back in 2016. Actually, I was retained as his attorney. I think it was probably 2013 by his family. So 2016 is when the trial took place.
So he was accused of and convicted of killing four people. And those crimes happened way before 2016 and 2013.
Correct.
Like, the first series of murders happened in 2008, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and then later, 2013, right?
Correct.
Okay, so
basically what goes on, I end up getting a phone call on like a Tuesday night at 3 a.m. And it's funny because I take it back. I got an email from Anthony Garcia's brother, Fernando.
Who emails? But that's so 2013.
Yeah. And I think that they had found our website.
He didn't fax you?
He didn't fax me. No, he paged me. Yeah. So and it was weird because I never, ever, ever would go into like kind of our computer room at like 2:30 in the morning and like check our work email. Like, it never happens. But on that particular night, for whatever reason, I did. You know, I see that this guy like emailed me about his brother getting arrested down in the southern county in Illinois that was about 5 hours away from us. So I'm like, all right. And I think Allison and I had like had a huge fight that night. So I go down, you know, I, for whatever reason, I look at the computer, I see the email, I decide at that time, and it's 2:30 here, so it would have been, you know, 12:30 in California. I call the guy. And so he starts telling me this story about his brother who was down in Jackson County, Southern Illinois, that he had gotten arrested. And he says, well, I think he got arrested for a DUI. So immediately I'm like, look, man, you know, no disrespect here, but you know, I'm up near Chicago. I'm not driving 5 hours for a DUI. You know, I'm just not doing that. He's like, well, you know, it sounds like they're talking about like murder, like that they may be charging him with a murder. And so then at that point, my, you know, interest is piqued, which obviously is kind of a strange thing. You know, but I'm a defense attorney. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's something I would drive down to Southern Illinois for. So I go wake Allison up and I'm like, I think we just got a murder case. So she's like, what? You know, she gets up. We decide, you know, we find somebody to watch the kids and we take the drive down there. So we get down to Jackson County and he is in holding, obviously. We go meet with him. And, you know, we advise him that his family had found us and that, at least initially we were going to represent him maybe for the extradition hearing. So, you know, an extradition, if you're out there and you don't know what it is, it's like if you're arrested in one state, that state obviously doesn't have jurisdiction to try the case. So they have to extradite you to the state where they are going to try the case. In this case, it would have been Nebraska. So, you know, we talked to him about it. It didn't seem like there was going to be a real way to be able to fight the extradition. Eventually, they were going to get him over there. So we waive extradition, and the case gets transferred along with our client to Douglas County over in Omaha. And, you know, from that point forward, we were able to negotiate a fee with his folks who paid his legal fees, and we ended up representing Garcia. And, you know, at the time that we took on the case, we didn't know that he was being charged with four murders. We just thought it was one because they didn't give us much information in terms of when we got down there.
We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. I think we need to backtrack because we're talking about your role in the trial, but there's so much that happened before 2013. So we probably need to fill in our listeners on all the shit that happened before that.
I think that's a good idea. So basically what goes on with Garcia, like I said, he was born and raised in California, goes to med school at the University of Utah, ends up getting his residency in the forensic pathology department at Creighton University in Omaha, ends up having some problems when he's there. Like kind of the bigger issue for him is he pulled what he, you know, they termed it as a prank. It was extremely sophomoric. Apparently what he did is he decided to take it upon himself. And there was another resident that was with him when they made this phone call. They make some kind of prank phone call to the wife of another resident who happened to be taking his licensing exam for like level five examination. Mm-hmm. Calls the wife, says, "Hey, you know, we're calling from Creighton. We just wanted to let you know that we know that your husband is currently taking his exam, but the problem is that his vacation time wasn't approved and he's got to leave the exam immediately and get back to Creighton." Wow. Obviously that was all bullshit. Creates quite a stir in the department. They figure out pretty quickly who made the call. Garcia gets admonished, but at that point doesn't get fired.
So that's not even a funny joke. Why would he have done that? Did he just hate that person or what?
Right. It's not even remotely funny. It's just, no. It's cruel. You know, there's no, like you said, there's nothing that's humorous about that situation.
So that was like the first person on his list that he had it out for. Yeah, luckily, he just did that and didn't kill him.
Yeah, I don't even know that he had any kind of real distaste for that person in particular. I think he was just being kind of a cruel asshole. I think if you kind of bottom line it, you know, because I like in all the discovery I got, I never read anything about him having any kind of issue with that guy prior to that thing occurring. So why that happened, I don't know. And when I asked my client, he really didn't have an answer for me either. So he survives that at Creighton. They keep him on for a while. He's not a great student, has issues. You know, there's a situation where he was, you know, they have to go and attend like X number of autopsies, you know, because he's a, you know, forensic pathologist. They're dealing with dead bodies all the time. Apparently one time when he's doing this, he was signed in, they know it was him, and he ends up, after the autopsy is performed, he leaves the body laying face down, which is a massive no-no. So what's starting to happen is he's building up like a real shit list of things that he shouldn't be doing, just things that are not professional. He's a licensed doctor at that point. I mean, when you're going in for your residency, like that's when you want to specialize in a certain area of medicine. So, you know, there he was obviously trying to get his, you know, residency done, you know, so that he could be a forensic pathologist.
This is so reminiscent. I know I probably said this before, of Dr. Death. Just incompetency. You can see it right out the gate. Like,
yeah,
he just wasn't doctor material.
He wasn't, you know, and it's like I've never been a huge fan of going to the doctor. And I can tell you definitively after this case, I was even less inclined to go to the doctor. I probably have, like, I'm probably teeming with disease just because I refuse to go to the doctor.
Well, that's unsettling.
Yeah, I mean, for real.
Well, so I had a major injury and I have lots of screws holding my left arm together right now. But if I had been doing this at that time and known what I know now, I probably would have just let my arm fall off.
Yeah, I mean, or even worse, if you had gone to, say, like Dr. Anthony Garcia, you'd probably have a stump. you know? So, I mean, you'd probably be an amputee. So yeah, he was, you know, had a hard time. The final straw for him at Creighton was he had some kind of beef with one of his instructors.
Was that, what's the last name?
Na, na,
H.
Na, na, na.
Bueller.
Hunter.
Hunter. Bueller.
Not
Bueller.
Not Bueller.
Bueller.
Hunter.
Chandra Butra. You were close. And you know what? You said it earlier, so you were real, you did. Yeah, you're there. You're there. So he had some kind of beef with this woman, and you know, I guess it got heated. And he said some ugly things, and you know.
Not only did he say some ugly things, but he was off the rails. Like,
yeah, he was inclined.
Everyone
to
knew
do
there
that.
Was something not quite right with him.
Yeah,
am I right?
He was definitely an odd duck. There's no question about that. However, being an odd duck does not make you a murderer.
I'm so, an odd duck, and I've never killed anyone.
Well, that is very settling to me. I'm glad to know that you don't kill people, but
I don't,
you know, so this guy, it falls apart for him there. Basically, Bill Hunter, who was, the chair of the department, or not, I'm sorry, the director of the department, comes to Garcia and says, "Hey, look, it's not working out here. You know, you can see that. You don't have to be a rocket scientist." He had asked Garcia to apologize to Butra. He's like, "I'm not doing that under any circumstances." Yeah. And he, like, Anthony played the race card a lot. You know, he felt like he was always being discriminated against because he had a Hispanic origin. Didn't work for him. And ultimately, Hunter says, "Look, I'm going to work to get you a residency somewhere else. You know, I'm not trying to ruin your career here."
And this is where it reminds me of the Dr. Death Netflix docuseries, because...
Was that the first season?
Second.
No, I didn't watch it or listen to
Christian
it.
Christian Slater, you watched it.
That wasn't Dr. Death. That was fucking...
Dr. Death.
No, that was John, the one with the wife where she ends up killing him.
That was Dirty John.
Oh, yeah, that's Dirty John. That was Christian Slater.
What? He was in that, too.
Oh, that was the first season, because I've only watched the first season of that shit. Yeah, that was with the guy who was doing the back surgeries, who kept pulling people's discs
out.
Making debilitating injuries. Everyone's paraplegic.
Yes.
Yeah, that was the first season, so get your shit right.
This is where it reminds me of that docuseries a lot, because they didn't just say, "Nope, you can't practice medicine. You are totally incompetent," which he was. They were like, "Let's just pass you along to someone else." Right.
Right? It's very, very similar to that. And, you know, and that kind of was the theme throughout his medical career. And I'm talking about Garcia, which really did mirror kind of what was going on in Dr. Death, where, you know, obviously all these institutions knew that this guy had massive issues. Like, that guy was a researcher. Like, he had a brilliant mind, but he was no surgeon, you know?
You know, people want to talk about the good old boy network in, like, certain aspects of life, especially conservative things and stuff like that. But in the medical industry, the medical field, there is a good old boy network going on, and they cover for each other.
Oh,
and
massively.
They won't ever, like, throw anyone under the bus. Like,
yeah,
that doesn't
happen.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
So well, that and, definitely and was a thing here.
Definitely. And, you know, kind of going back to that point, like when you look at medical malpractice cases, like always the toughest part of that case is finding an expert, which would have to be a doctor who's going to be able to come into court and testify against other doctors that they had, you know, that they acted negligently, you know, that they had provided services that were below the normal standard of care. So, and it's really hard to find doctors that are willing to do that. And, you know, the guys that do that are typically pariahs, you know, because of exactly what you're talking about, because they really take care of each other in terms of, and it all stems from liability, you know, because those medical malpractice cases are bell ringers. You know, I mean, it's easier to tell when a lawyer fucks up, you know, it's like, "Oh, look, you clearly didn't call any of these witnesses who obviously should have called all, you know," it's more evident in terms of if a lawyer has neglected a case, whereas, you know, typically when you're talking about something with a surgeon, it's internal, you know? So in terms of whatever they may have fucked up, And, you know, I mean, if somebody clips an artery when they're in there, it's not necessarily negligent. You know, I mean, shit happens. It's close quarters in there, you know, so it's tough, you know, and it's like doctors are it's a tough thing for them to go in and say, look, you know, if I were in the same situation, there's no way that would have happened, you know, so but. Kind of getting back to Garcia, that's a terrifying concept. It's like I was telling you before we came on air, you know, when I found out that he was a licensed surgeon in the state of Illinois, it horrified me, you know, and irrespective of whether or not, you know, he had killed anybody or not, just me kind of getting to know him, the concept of him being able to open somebody up on an operating table was terrifying to me. Fortunately, he never got to that point. Like, he never actually operated anybody. So I'm sure that all the people that potentially could have been his patients are very thankful for that.
Exactly.
But so I want to jump into that serial killer thing. Yeah. And the one thing that you, in terms of kind of like the time and the numbers, I disagree with you. But what I do agree with you, I think that a typical situation with serial killers is that oftentimes they do have a mental illness aspect that kind of drives them. And kind of the thing with Anthony Garcia, at least the theory of the state was that it was a revenge theme, you know, like that he was paying them back for ruining his career by firing him at Creighton, that set him down a road of just kind of despair and kind of like set his medical career on a path that he just couldn't get it back on the tracks. So in that sense, I kind of agree with you, because if you compare him to like your typical serial killer, they are typically dealing with some kind of narcissistic, which Garcia definitely was a narcissist.
Definitely.
You know? Like when I sat in the room with him, you know, and my father tried that case with me, you know, so he had the comparison to make between when he defended Gacy and Garcia, which was fascinating, like that, like having my father try that case. And that was the one and only case I ever tried with him, you know, but I could always draw on his experience in dealing with Gacy in terms of trying to deal with Garcia. You know?
I would love to hear your dad say, here's the difference. Like, here's how he was with this and contrast and all of that.
And it was really pretty fascinating. And, you know, the one thing that my father and I would always say to each other, you know, is that like Gacy, much like Garcia, always thought that they were the smartest guy in the room. You know, that was just kind of
like you.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, I mean, he had that kind of mentality, you know, it's like he always thought anything that he was saying to us, it was like going over our heads, and, right, you know, and when you have a client like that, you kind of have to play the game with them. Mm-hmm. Because you do want them to trust you.
I can only imagine.
Right. It's like I wasn't calling bullshit on him. You know what I mean? Like whenever he'd say something that would, you know, kind of set off an alarm, I wouldn't be like, you know, I would never call bullshit on him on that type of stuff, just because I needed to develop a real kind of trust with him in terms of us defending him in this type of case. So, but yeah, like his whole thing at Creighton went awry. He ends up going to University of Chicago, Illinois, which is in the city of Chicago, and he gets a residency there. Now, the most interesting thing about that, because part of the state's theory was, you know, this poor young 10-year-old boy that was murdered by, Garcia was convicted of it. So
that's devastating. And we're going to get into the details of that in a little bit.
It was horrific.
Yeah.
It was horrific. It was frankly, for me, you know, all of the people losing their lives was horrific, but that young boy with the way that he was left in terms of the state of his body was extremely hard for me to digest. Yeah, just had his whole shit set up. He was ready. He was down there. He was gaming. He was actually gaming when the doorbell rang.
And when his dad found him, the video game music was like
still playing
loud. And
right.
He has said that's all he remembers is that video game music and the blood and all of that.
Going into that case, and we'll kind of get into that later when we kind of give you guys the background of what we're talking about with the case, but that was a, like, my ability to even be able to look at the photographs, I was extremely concerned whether I'd be able to do that. Like, honestly, you know.
you've seen all the photographs. You've seen a lot of shit.
I've seen a lot of shit.
How do you deal with that as a parent?
It's hard.
Yeah.
It really is, you know, because I myself have four kids and, you know, that was challenging. You know, like in terms of like just going into it before we even got the discovery, you know, before we got the pictures, you know, I was saying, man, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this, you know. Yeah, no, that was, you know, I'd handled a lot of stuff. I was probably 15 years into practice at that point. I'd handled a lot of, you know, pretty gruesome things, but nothing like that. That was like the first case where I was dealing with a child being murdered, and it was extremely challenging for me. But yeah, so kind of jumping back, and I know, sorry out there, but we're jumping back a little bit.
It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah, it's fluid.
Y'all stick with us because this is going to be a multi-parter. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it'll be good too. So Garcia ends up, you know, he takes this residency, but you know, the interesting thing, and when we kind of get to the trial portion of what we're talking about, one of the main theories that the state had put forth was that, you know, Hunter was kind of the main guy who had like fucked up his career by firing him. All right. So that was like real big in terms of their narrative. And the reality of it was, is that Hunter had written the letter and called a friend that was at UIC who said, hey, we got this guy here. It's just not a good fit for us, but we think he'll be a good fit for you. He ends up getting him his next job, that residency at UIC. So it's like, this guy didn't really, like, he gave him multiple chances when probably other doctors wouldn't have given him the same opportunity. And then he ends up going and, you know, he kind of fucks that one up at UIC as well. And, you know, from that point forward, so that's, you know, you're probably putting that at like 2003, you know, like when he gets to UIC and kind of fucks that thing up too, you know. And then from there on forward, you know, he doesn't really join any more residency programs. At some point down the road, he decides that he wants to try to get into LSU's, one of their residency programs. All right. So, but that's years down the road. And in the interim, he's doing all kinds of work, you know, like he works at clinics. He got a job with the prison industry in Indiana. And, you know, he worked there for about a year. And like everywhere that he was, it's kind of like what you were saying early on. He just had this tendency to kind of like pop off on people, you know?
Yeah. And like everyone knew there was something like not quite right about him. And I just feel like in the medical field, they just pass the rogue person on to the next.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, right. And, you know, like, as you know, I mean, bedside manner counts in terms of being a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of an important factor in terms of.
I mean, there are so many doctors who have zero bedside manner, but they're also not yelling at their patients.
Or their coworkers.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, they can actually, like, coexist with someone and function and work in a normal work environment. And he was not one of those people.
Right. That's 100% true. Like, he had problems. And they weren't, again, like, these aren't the type of problems where you automatically say, oh my God, this guy's a killer. But their problems were, it kind of shows that he has a hard time finding his place and fitting in.
Yeah, and like problems where you can see that he's not going to excel at patient care or advocating for his patients or really just function in any capacity in a medical field.
Right, exactly. You know, so that kind of continues on. And then if we fast forward to 2008... and we bring ourselves to Omaha, Nebraska, and it's like March 13th, regular school day. Young Thomas Hunter is getting off the bus. And it's in this neighborhood of Omaha, which I was a licensed attorney in Illinois. So I wasn't familiar with Omaha until I got on the case. And then I obviously became very familiar with Omaha. I actually moved out there for the trial for months. But, you know, this particular neighborhood called Dundee was beautiful, like real upscale bedroom neighborhood. It's where all the people with wealth lived. And Omaha's got a lot of money. Like, there's just, like, Warren Buffett lives out there. There's,
has a lot of money and a lot of conspiracy and controversy, too.
It does. It really does.
There's a lot of shit going down in Omaha.
There was a lot of shit. And it's funny that you say that, because probably what you're going to end up talking about is things that we were...
Sex trafficking.
Yeah, there was that. And there was a lot of what appeared to be within the medical examiner's office. There was a lot of issues with that particular office in conjunction with the criminal justice system out there. They had some real issues, which were things that we were looking into, because we were leaving no stone unturned in terms of trying to defend the case. But see, that's the thing that kind of goes back to the Dr. Death type situation, where, you know, like, his deficiencies weren't necessarily following him to, like, wherever he would go next. I had every report, I had everything in our discovery, which, and now that you bring that up, just so my listeners out there know, after the second Gacy tape season, we will be doing our second full season on Dr. Anthony Garcia.
That was random.
Yeah, so that no, it was actually a great segue. Thanks, Kelly.
I don't think it was, actually. You were like, I'm talking about blowing my nose, and then I'm going to talk about...
Oh, it was a great segue.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. It's going to be a super deep dive. You know how I do out there.
I know how you do.
So, I mean, I think he ends up, you know, the UIC thing wasn't necessarily that he was butting heads with anybody there. Like, he kind of got to UIC after he left Creighton, which they allowed him to resign. You know, they didn't technically fire him from Creighton.
They just passed him on because they didn't want to deal with him.
Right. So there's definitely that aspect. So he ends up at UIC, and it doesn't go well there. But he didn't have the same type of issues. He had different issues, but they were all kind of medical issues that he claimed that he was having. You know, he was claiming that he was having
headaches.
Very, very severe headaches, like debilitating headaches.
Every serial killer I cover, they always talk about headaches they had when they were younger, or like when they were committing the crimes. It's always like traumatic brain injury or concussions. They always say the same thing. I had these horrible headaches and blackouts.
I think that that's a link, for sure. I really do, because...
Yeah, something that they need to look into, right?
I agree. I think, you know, in retrospect, when you're looking back at, like, older cases where, you know, now we know about things like CTE, you know, and we kind of, like, grew to know about that, and it was born out of, like, the football head injuries that were occurring, where, you know, you had these football players that were starting to kill themselves or getting super violent with their spouses, you know, and kind of like going off the rails. And people were like, well, what the fuck's going on with the NFL players? So they finally have to, and that was a huge fight, you know, because the NFL is huge money, and it's tied in with Vegas, and it's a whole thing. There's a lot of money at stake there.
They do a lot with pro wrestling, and I would say they had less intervention. They had less help in the pro wrestling industry. They had a lot of traumatic brain injuries too, and that's why there are so many murders and crazy, like, crime stories linked to WWF. WWE, and then even UFC, like,
yeah, or even boxing, you know, all of it.
Like, there's so many murders, like domestic assaults, and just a lot of crazy stories that are in that genre, and that's why I like to cross over with that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I think it's an excellent point. And I think that it's certainly, because as soon as you mentioned that, I automatically started thinking about, like, the Gacy tapes. Like, my father asks him if he ever had a head injury, and he did.
And he did.
And he did.
He did. Yeah, I talked about it in my live episode.
And so did Garcia.
Yeah.
And Garcia played football for all 4 years in high school, you know, and I think these headaches started, like, when he was 17, 18 for Garcia.
But nobody really acknowledges it.
But they should.
They should.
They should, right. Acknowledge it, that it's a problem.
It is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, if you think about, you know, essentially when you're talking about a concussion, you're talking about your brain slamming against your skull. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, literally, for a concussion, your brain is smashing against your skull.
You don't always come back from from that and people don't look into it later.
Right. And I think that's a clear link. You know, I agree. I mean, that's too.
One of my platforms in life in general, like mental health and sports injuries and concussions. And I probably talk about it in about every episode that I do on True Crime IRL. But I think we need to look into it a lot more.
I could not agree more, you know, and like it's a conversation for another day. But you know,
totally.
But I'm with you, and I know you and I have discussed like this mental health aspect, and it's always been, for as long as I've been practicing law, you know, the way that aspect, mental health, has been ignored.
It's always ignored. It's always ignored, and
it's unbelievable. I mean, just now, it's finally starting to come to light, like where it's being acknowledged.
Because people who are like high profile are just now starting to say, "Hey, I battle this." There's such a stigma. So
totally, yeah. But you know, it's like it's even worse than that. It's like that it's just not acknowledged as a possibility that people are suffering from mental illness, in terms of like maybe quantifying why they've done what they've done.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, it has to be taken into consideration. You know, I mean, for somebody who is otherwise a normal person to kind of just one day go off the rails where I've had multiple clients that have lived completely, I'm talking guys that are in their 50s and 60s who lived completely normal, happy lives, raised families, happy marriages, all of a sudden one day just fucking lose their mind, you know? And it's one of those things where to ignore the aspect of mental health, it's unbelievable to me. And it's been so frustrating me, you know, to like train, oh my God. Like
I can imagine. As a criminal defense lawyer, I would think that like a lot of your cases have a mental health aspect.
I would say a majority.
Yeah.
A majority. And me trying to convince a prosecutor that mental health is an issue in the case is like, you know, it's literally banging my head against a wall because it's so frustrating.
But it's so plain to see in my eyes, but I just don't get how they don't take that into...
Believe me, either do I. You know, it befuddles me on a daily basis. You know, like, honestly, I'm like...
Is it getting better in this day?
You know what? It's starting to. Like in the counties that I practice in most prevalently now, they've actually established mental health courts, which is like beautiful to see. And, you know, because what that does is it incorporates social workers, it incorporates doctors. Mm-hmm. So people that are qualified to handle mental health issues are brought into the situation. And, you know, so basically the job of the lawyer on the front end of a case where you think that your client is having some mental health issues, you know, I'm trying to convince the prosecutor to agree that, like, look at it. This is the facts that we're dealing with. We need to seriously take into consideration that this guy has some serious mental health issues. Let's address it, you know. So that's like, that becomes my job in cases like that, is to convince the prosecutors to say, okay, you know, I think you're right. Let's, because it depends on the type of case, because if it's a violent case where there's like, you know, a real victim centric case where, you know, somebody was injured severely or killed, it's hard for them, you know, it's hard for them to either go to the family and say, look, you know, we want this guy to pay the price, you know, we want justice to prevail, but you know, the bottom line is that this guy is probably suffering from some mental illness. Families don't want to hear that shit. You know what I mean? Like victims' families are like, I don't care. I want this guy punished. You know, he did something horrific to my family. You know, so it's like, it's a tough role for them.
I know. And I can't put myself in those shoes, but I'm going to for a second. I feel like I would care. I feel like I would be like, that's not who they are. We need to address like the mental health aspect.
Yeah, but I think you're the minority there. I mean, I wish everyone were like you. I mean, honestly, because that like we'd live in a much different world if it were that way, you know, but a lot of people, you know, if they suffer some kind of massive blow, whether it be to a loved one or what have you, it's hard to kind of take that broad look at things because you're feeling so much pain and anger that it clouds your vision to be able to kind of look at it in a more, you know, myopic type of way where you're saying, okay, well, you know, yeah, maybe that is a thing. It's tough. It's a tough battle to win, like a majority of the times, you know, but the one thing that happens is a lot of time, you know, like that old saying, time heals all wounds.
Doesn't.
But what it does do is it sometimes allows people to take a step back, take a breath and say, all right, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
You know, if this person is acting out of their nature, if they, you know, if it's a 50-year-old person that's lived a completely normal life and has done something completely out of character, then, you know, then let's take a look at that, you know, because I mean, it's a tough situation. So, So Garcia does the UIC thing, starts suffering from these massive migraines that are debilitating to him to the extent where he can't function, you know, at least that's what he's telling them.
Right.
You know, so that ends up not working out, and that goes on for like another year. So that puts us at like 2004. So then he just kind of starts picking up odd jobs, you know, at like clinics and like kind of, I think the one situation that you're talking about where he explodes on some person, I think what it ends up boiling down to is he tells somebody to suck his dick, like somebody that he worked with. Like it, and I don't know if it, I can't remember exactly if it was the Indiana prison system or if it was another kind of a clinic that he was working at, but he like exploded on somebody, just kind of like lost his shit completely, you know, acts inappropriately. And like, I think literally says the words, you know, why don't you suck my fucking dick? So he ends up getting shit canned from that job. You know, so it kind of like goes on like that for years where he would pick up work. He would always get hired somewhere else. And he's a doctor, so he was still making a decent living, you know.
He can't really manage day-to-day life.
No, that's for certain. I got to know him pretty well, and I never saw that side of him. You know what I mean?
He never got mad at you?
No. So, I mean, and we'll talk about, like, I wouldn't say mad, but like kind of when he shut down, almost like robotic in a sense, like he just shut down. But it's for later in the episode. It was after.
Yeah, it is. But was there like a day and a time where he just shut down and it never came back?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But I'll tell you about that later.
I know.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was like literally, it was like almost discernible. Yeah. I could see it, you know, like as soon as the words came out of my mouth, it was like I turned off a switch and
wow.
And it never came back.
So at this point, Bob and I have discussed some of the factors that contributed to the downfall of Anthony Garcia. And this is where we're going to end part one of our multi-part episode. There are a lot more interesting details in this case coming your way in part two, as well as Bob Mata's firsthand account of the Anthony Garcia trial as Garcia's criminal defense attorney. You won't want to miss it. Be sure to check out The Defense Diaries, hosted by Bob Mata and produced by Darren Wood. They're currently in Season 1, The Gacy Tapes, and Season 2 is in the works right now. It's one of my favorite true crime podcasts, and I actually do listen to it. It's one of the few that I actually have time for or make time to listen to, so I highly recommend it. Bob, Darren, and I will all be at the Savannah Crime Expo in Savannah, Georgia on Saturday, September 25th, along with many of your other favorite true crime podcasters and speakers. So if you've been on the fence about going to the event, just buy the tickets and go. It's going to be a blast. And Savannah is an amazing city. Let's explore it together. True Crime IRL is produced and hosted by Kelly Behrens Brink and part of TNC Productions. Your 5-star ratings and reviews are always appreciated on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And believe it or not, they go a long way in growing the show, so thank you. Please go to truecrimeirl.com for more information about the show, and be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at the handle truecrimeirl, all one word. The True Crime IRL Patreon is also a great way to support the podcast, and I really appreciate your contributions there. This has been Kelly Barron's Brink from True Crime IRL, and until next time, you know the drill. Lock your doors, people. Just lock them. Do it. Just lock those doors. Bye-bye.